The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why did it take you 7 years to earn your undergraduate degree?
It took me 7 years to graduate from college because of a few reasons. One, I had discovered a world I had never seen before, and that world didn't really exist in the classroom. It was everything going on outside of the classroom. So I was in a fraternity, for example, and I just sort of misbehaved for 7 years. Also, the other reason is, and this is not really a cop-out, but I'm a first-generation college student. I just did not understand how it worked, you know, and I didn't really have an advisor. So it was kind of like moving around in the dark trying to figure out how to get through this big room called college.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Sheree Newman, and my guest is Idaho author Brandon Schrand. We're talking about his second memoir, a book titled Works Cited, an alphabetical odyssey of mayhem and misbehavior. So describe the place where you grew up. I know you moved around a little bit, but specifically your hometown of Soda Springs, Idaho. What was it like? And tell us a little bit about your family.
Soda Springs, Idaho is in southeastern Idaho, and it's not too far north of the Utah border. So you have, it's kind of an interesting demographic. It's about 3,000 people. It's a mining town whose chief employer is Monsanto. And that's something that I've sort of wrestled with over a number of years. There's a large Latter-day Saint population there, but it's not all Latter-day Saints. There's kind of a mix of people. I grew up in a working-class, blue-collar family, first-gen college student. My family owned and operated the Ender's Hotel and Cafe and Bar, which was the subject of my first book. And it was small-town America. It was small-town America in the 80s, and my parents and grandparents ran this business together, and they were very busy. So I was off exploring with my friends and rafting down Soda Creek and just goofing off. We didn't have iPhones and iPads, so we were always outside making our own fun. And sometimes that fun led us to trouble, but it was usually fun.
You often mixed up your fun activities with what you read in books. And in books, you learned that the rest of the world was not like Soda Springs, which might be what attracted you to reading in the first place. But you had to learn over and over again that fiction, even if it's inspired by reality, is not reality. And I think your first experience, your first really solid experience with that was after you read The Mad Scientist Club. And I'd like you to read just the first two paragraphs of that essay.
Brinley Bertrand R., The Mad Scientist Club, New York, Scholastic, 1965. When I was 11 and in that sunset year of childhood when it took actual concentration to discern the diaphanous line between daydreams and reality, when the stories I read so fully colored my day-to-day loafing in rural Idaho that I seldom knew where the page ended and the world began, I picked up a particular book about a gang of goofy kids whose lives I wanted to be my own so badly that it left me aching in the joyous ways books often leave us, high yet abandoned somehow. The feeling when you have it is tactile and intoxicating. It is like love or victory or surrender. Set in the nostalgic and quaint town of Mammoth Falls, the Mad Scientist Club centers on a group of boy geniuses whose singular occupation was to hatch harebrained schemes to save their town or themselves from one kind of danger or another. Led by Jeff Crocker, the bespectacled Henry Mulligan, the main brain, the club met daily in their headquarters, which was outfitted in the loft of Jeff Crocker's barn. They had an in-house laboratory complete with microscopes and vials of solutions and compounds. They had telescopes, transmitters, toolboxes, plenty of books, and endless days to fill. It was a world that felt to me actual, a realm whose cinematic stories stamped my imagination, and I never wanted it to end.
And so you started your own club. Did you buy some of the equipment with your grandmother's green stamps or something?
it's worse than green stamps. She was a smoker. So she smoked Raleigh Bel Air menthols, and each pack of cigarettes came with a coupon. And if you saved these coupons, they'd sent you a catalog, and you could order stuff. Like, I ordered a raft, for example, and a telescope. And so there was this weird kind of dynamic where I'd be like, come on, Grandma, keep smoking because I want to get this telescope. And she's like, I can only smoke so many a day, you know, and she had this gravelly voice. And I look back on that now and I'm just horrified by that dynamic. But to us, it was just normal. And so, yeah, I used the cigarette coupons to finance the early equipment operations of the Mad Scientist Club, brought to you by Raleigh Bel Air.
And so you organized your club, but it didn't really turn out the way you thought it would.
No, it was a disaster. I had these, you know, high-flown dreams of what we could do and what we might be able to build and conceive. And, you know, we were like 11 or 12, so I mean, we were just incapable boys who had better ideas of dreams than reality. And it just sort of dissolved and fell apart, and we tinkered around with things. I set up an office in my family's hotel basement, and that was about as, I think we met twice, something like that. So,
and if I remember correctly from the first time you met, everybody got in the room, and then it was like,
now what?
Yeah, what do we do now?
So what are we going to do now? And then we just probably started, I think we started talking about girls or something, and I was trying to keep the meeting on track and trying to keep 11, 12-year-old boys on track. I know because I have a son is a lot of work, so it doesn't always happen.
Well, in spite of those kinds of experiences, you continued to read, and then you decided to go to college, much to your parents' surprise. Mm-hmm. No one else had been to college. And you write about that in your essay about Ralph Waldo Emerson.
When I announced to my parents that I wanted to go to college, their response wasn't anything like I had imagined it to be. I thought they'd be thrilled, jubilant, and would exhaust themselves in the fever of the good news. I thought they would make cakes and place telephone calls to far-flung relatives. Instead, they felt ambushed. I was in my senior year, and only now had I mentioned college. Most parents in that broad economic band we call the middle class have these discussions early on when their children are still olive-sized in the womb. Strangely, we hadn't really discussed my future in any substantive way. A generational, familial, and to some extent cultural demographic pattern was in place that unraveled the need for such sit-down kitchen table discussions, and that pattern looked something like this. 1. Go to school, school here meaning elementary and secondary school. 2. Graduate from school. A. Or don't graduate from school. 3. Get a job, agricultural, or more typically at one of the mines in town. 4. Stay with that job. 4A. Or don't stay with that job, either by way of firing, unacceptable, quitting, frowned upon, or layoff, common in a town like Soda Springs. B. Get a new job, etc., and repeat A and B until you stay with one job. 5. Get married. 6. Find a place, usually a trailer to begin, then upgrade to a modular, rambler, or post-war home, etc. 7. Have kids. 8. Retire. The assumption, I guess, was that I would simply take to the currents of that pattern as easily as one takes to sleep and the ebb of dreams that follows. And to be completely honest, I had at one point craved that pattern of what I called normal. I had been in that all-too-familiar teenage crisis where I wanted a normal life. I lived in a hotel, not a house. I ate in a cafe, not a dining room. I had a parking lot, not a yard. So when I visited my friends' modular, rambler, or post-war homes and their savory kitchen scents and their green lawns and their musty garages, I ached to be a part of it. I wanted what they had. The irony here, of course, is that all my friends wanted to live in a hotel, eat in a cafe, and ride around in a parking lot on their bike and have no lawn to mow. The closer I got to graduation, however, the more I ached for a different dream, one that cast me far away from the generational pattern. Let me be clear here, though. There isn't anything wrong with the pattern I listed above. What I call a pattern, others call the American dream, and it may well be. In fact, I'm sure it is for a great many people. But I wanted to break the pattern because while it existed as a dream for some, it had morphed into something of a nightmare for me. I wanted new dreams, the ones I got from books.
And so you went off to college. And this packing list that you have here is really funny, and I'd like you to read that too. In addition to the 8 books you packed in your trunk, you present this list in the Great Gatsby essay.
Yeah, because I had no idea what college was about or what to take, so I ended up taking these items. contents of my big red trunk other than the 8 books. 1. Cassette tape carrying case featuring Metallica, numerous as mentioned, Kiss, Old School, and compilations, Faster Pussycat, Jane's Addiction, David Bowie, Howard Jones, The Cure, The Cult, Jesus Jones, EMF, Led Zeppelin, Steve Miller, The Eagles, The Doors, and others. 2. A turquoise fanny pack. I have no idea why. 3. Flowery bed sheets my mother sent me to college with. 4. Pink towels my mother sent me to college with. First, I'm not sure what she was thinking. She didn't shop for new stuff like most parents do when sending their kids off to college. She just grabbed shit around the house we never used, like the pink fluffy towels, for instance, and the flowery bed sheets. Second, I have no idea what I was thinking in taking the stuff to college. Shouldn't pink towels and flowery bed sheets raise some alarms for most people? How can a kid with rocker long hair and a penchant for Metallica not see where Ride the Lightning ends and pink fluffy towels begin? How can he not see the disconnect? Where, oh, where was the protest? 5. Flowery comforter. Egad, it's very painful to write. But yes, there was a poofy, whitish comforter with delicate flowers reaching here and there across its folds, a filigree of wretchedness. 6. A turquoise bum equipment hat, Velcro backstrap, and a really long bill. 7. 2 high school yearbooks. Very embarrassing, very painful to write, but yes, technically I packed 10 books. Taking high school yearbooks to college was tantamount to taking your letterman's jacket, and believe me, had I lettered in anything worthy of earning a jacket, I would have packed the sucker in the trunk of embarrassment. 8. Coat and snow pants. Not so embarrassing, except the coat was fluorescent yellow with pink trim. The coat matched, embarrassingly, my Luc Lamar snowboard, which was also fluorescent yellow with pink trim. Hang on a second. There seems to be a pattern of pinkishness here. First, in my defense, this was 1991. I just emerged from the 1980s, and I had been a rocker. Male rock stars look like females. Consider the argument my friends and I had when first seeing the cover of Poison's Look What the Cat Dragged In. They're chicks. No, they're dudes. Chicks, dudes, and so on. Dudes wore pink all the time. Witness Vince Neil circa Theater of Pain tour. Second, why am I getting so defensive about this? 9. Oakley sunglasses. 10. An extra swatch that had, as you guessed it, a pink wristband. Once you open the trunk of embarrassment, there's just no slamming it shut. That's, it's even more embarrassing to read it on an interview. Thanks for that.
I think it's hysterical. Yeah. Well, let's back up just a little bit and go back to when you were in high school. You were trying to forge an identity for yourself in this small town where everybody was a little bit generic, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so describe what you were like in high school.
I was student body vice president, but I was also class clown, voted, I think, 2 or 3 years in a row. And I didn't take school seriously, but my teachers liked me. For some reason, they tolerated my shenanigans. I was the consummate prankster, having succeeded in putting a bathtub on the roof of the high school with several friends and putting a toilet in the middle of Main Street. We stole one night every real estate sign in town and put them in the high school as a joke, like our high school's for sale. It's just corny now, but we thought it was quite hilarious at the time. Just things like that. But I never really got in trouble. Not serious trouble. People just sort of shook their head, and that's Brandon and his friends. I had a whole lot of fun, and to forge my identity, because I was kind of working class, blue collar kind of kid looking upward to try to hang out with the cool kids or the popular kids, I would study them. What do they wear and what are they like? And I was sort of chameleonic in that way. And it sounds kind of icky to me now that I did that, but I did. I remember once when my friends who were of that kind of the quote upper class of Soda Springs, which there really isn't, but my friends, they worked at the grocery store, so they wore a shirt and tie and pants to work. They showered before work. I showered when I got home from work because I worked on a farm and I worked for a drill rig. And I remember having a conversation with my mom saying, I want to shower before I go to work. I don't want to shower when I get home from work. And that was a clear break in the kind of family pattern that we had. But I also, I would read books about kids going off to college. And that just seemed like a dream to me. And I didn't know what college was. So I would tinker with that idea. But then on the other hand, I would read S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders, and I would start carrying a switchblade because I thought I was a greaser and I could identify with that world. And I had a good amount of heady derision towards socias or those kids that I secretly was, I was studying that I wanted to be. So I was sort of occupying a kind of paradoxical identity, really not knowing who I was or what I was going to be. I just knew that I didn't want to be who I was at that time.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Brandon Schrand about his second memoir, Works Cited, An Alphabetical Odyssey of Mayhem and Misbehavior. There's information about him and the book at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Stay with us. After a short break, we'll talk about the influence of Ernest Hemingway and hear another short passage from the book. During your undergrad years, the writing of Ernest Hemingway seemed to influence you quite a bit. About that, you wrote, quote, "There exists a kind of danger when you introduce a certain brand of young man to the words of Hemingway. If literature is the great vicarious second version of our dreams, fears, and pities, then to live vicariously through Hemingway can prove to be a wreckful ambition, or at least it did for me." End quote. Aside from his writing, talk about your other reasons for putting Hemingway on a pedestal.
Well, there's an Idaho connection, right? So, and it turns out, it just so happens, and I didn't learn this until I was maybe in my later teen years, that my great uncle lived in Sun Valley and was friends with Hemingway. And my grandmother mentions this in just like random conversation. And I'm like, what, you know? They weren't like best friends. But what had happened was that because Hemingway had broken his back in a plane crash in Africa, he fractured his vertebrae and was quite banged up. My uncle, who worked for the Forest Service, had fallen off a horse and injured his back. So he was in the hospital. Hemingway had heard of this. So Hemingway would drop by the hospital to chat with my uncle, and they developed this kind of friendship back and forth. And I thought that was fascinating because here was this amazing writer who, when I thought of writers, I thought of New York. I never thought that a writer would have any attraction to Idaho, but Hemingway had a house in Idaho. And I thought that was amazing. But, you know, he typified the writer as celebrity, just led a kind of glamorous lifestyle. You know, he went on safari. He lived in Paris. What wasn't to like about that? But there were also some, you know, serious indulgences that came along with that lifestyle. So that's where the danger enters in. So there's that, it's that attraction, but, you know, be careful about those kind of alluring parts of his life that you want to emulate.
You also noticed that he didn't go to college.
Right. Here was a guy who was maybe the greatest short story writer in America who did not go to college, who learned how to write at the Kansas City Star. You know, there's another side of the story, and I talk about it, and that is that to grow up in Soda Springs, Idaho as a male and to love books, I was pretty alone in that world. There weren't many of us that read, and I had a couple of friends that did. One was in my band, actually, and he read quite a bit. But it was somehow, it just wasn't manly. It wasn't part of the codified world of masculinity. It was hunting, and which Hemingway did, and it was fishing, which Hemingway did. So Hemingway was an author I could bring up in casual conversation to people back home. as a way for me to be able to talk about writing, but on a level that they would identify with. In other words, he was a safe author to take home to talk about. Even if they hadn't read Hemingway, they knew who he was, and they knew about him. And so when I left home and went to college, he was kind of a lifeline back, so I could occupy both the insider and outsider roles of being in and out of Soda Springs, and I could talk about Hemingway.
Although he also represented a more self-destructive persona.
Well, there is a certain contingent of people in Soda Springs that would almost admire that in a weird way. You know, it's a kind of world where, like, drinking contests, for example, is like a popular thing to do. And it's also incredibly self-destructive, trying to, you know, outdo one another. And so, you know, there's that risk in celebrating the wrong parts of his life. And I definitely was trafficking in those risks in college. But I had to, finally, I had an awareness of that. That was the difference.
Mm-hmm. It was a phase that you were going through, right, when you were kind of trying out being this hard-drinking, mm-hmm, authorly kind of man.
Right. Right. And the same thing, I had this deep and dangerous fascination with Hunter S. Thompson as well. And so there, again, the same story.
Returning to the idea of confusing fiction with reality, there is one more passage about that I'd like you to read.
Hinton, S.E., The Outsiders, New York, Laurel Leaf, 1968. In the seventh grade, my literal voice was cracking with embarrassing frequency. I was gangly and awkward and had just been prescribed glasses. It was during this year that I had become aware, if only vaguely, that my family wasn't like those I read about or saw on television. We didn't do ski trips, the lake, or Orlando. We never used summer as a verb. The books lying around our home were of the variety that merely entertained, fat grocery store paperbacks with lurid titles and covers, mysteries and true crime and horror. In our world, the days and months and seasons were containers to be filled with work and work alone. A line had been drawn not between daydreams and the here and now, but between other kids whose families retreated to their cabins and those of us who wore long hair and heavy metal t-shirts that said it all, if it's too loud, you're too old. So when Mrs. Garrison, my seventh grade English teacher, passed around a book called The Outsiders, I felt my world lift a little. Here was one of the few assigned books I enjoyed. She told us to think about the title, to consider this book as a tale of those with and those without, and then shot me a steady glance and said, I think you'll like it. Of course I loved it, but as always I loved it for all the wrong reasons. I didn't merely sympathize with Johnny, Soda Pop, Pony Boy, et al. I empathized with them. And here it gets strange because while we were working class, we weren't poor by any means, and most of all, my parents were alive, unlike Pony Boy's. So the basis of my empathy was false and self-serving. I wanted to be poorer, more troubled, and badder than I was. In short, I wanted to be an outsider. I convinced myself that I understood that world of denim and switchblades and sneakers and long oiled hair. I'd convinced myself of it so thoroughly that I started to look like a character from the book, and so did a few of my friends. We wore our Levi jackets and denim jeans, and I carried a butterfly knife in my back pocket. We traded in our glasses for contacts, smoked cigarettes, and wore cynicism like a new skin. I remember wanting to live in a city, to have real alleys to prowl and to stake out as my own, to have territory and what people called street smarts, but we only had so many streets in my rural Idaho hometown, so street smarts were, by virtue of diminished geography, three traffic lights and a semaphore, were hard to come by. Our town did have one honest-to-goodness alley, which was behind the movie theater. It was a place of macadam and cement and bricks and cinder block walls and broken bottle glass and medallion-like puddles ringed with the oil-slick colors of the rainbow. So we called that our place. It suited us. There we could exhale drags of blue smoke, kick a brick wall, and spout backward ingrown teenage maxims like, this town blows or preppies are gay. And if I ever doubted our proclamations, I needed only to go to the outsiders to see a hardened, cruel world mirrored back to me. Becoming an outsider was an easy and satisfying way of exacting contradistinction, of drawing a line between realms. In other words, I had entered the world of fiction, casting myself as its lead character.
So in retrospect, do you think that reading all of those books helped or hindered your life in Soda Springs and then after you left?
In retrospect, I think reading those books even with some of the hard knocks that came as a result of my trying to emulate some of the characters or stories in them, they made me who I am, and I don't think I would trade that in. I think I was very lucky to, even though I lived in a home where, as I wrote, you know, my family read fat grocery store mysteries, there were still readers. You know, they read. It was a thing in our house that's to relax. It was an entertainment. Books were around more than television was. And I came by my books sort of piecemeal. A friend would suggest one, or I would hear something on TV about a book. My parents would suggest something, or my teachers would assign something like The Outsiders that I would actually really grab onto. And then, in fact, I went on to read Rumblefish Tex, and that was then, this is now, all of Hinton's books at the time. Yeah, I wouldn't change it at all. That was exciting to read those books, you know.
I think what I'm cluing in on is all of the angst and the problems and the social maladjustment that you experienced because you were trying to emulate people who weren't real,
right,
you know, in fiction.
Right. Yeah.
And as you said earlier, you would watch other people and try to be them so that you could get out of the life that you didn't want to stay in.
Right. I can look back on my teenage years and pretty clearly define, oh, that was my heavy metal stage. That was my skater stage. That was my, when I finally got accepted into like the preppy crowd. That was my preppy stage when I would, you know, go to Jackson Hole and we would buy Giorgio cologne at the outlets and spend all my money on polo shirts and this sort of thing. I was literally changing. I cut off all my hair, you know, so it was quite short and I looked like the other kids around me. And I started listening to the music that they listened to. And right as that was tipping, there was a moment in the book where I asked a friend of mine who was a year ahead of me. I was a senior and he was in college at Idaho State. And I said, tell me some books that I need to have to be able to take to college. And he wrote down this list of books. And I remember pulling a receipt from my wallet, but it was a Metallica wallet. And I wrote these books down and I went and bought them, you know, and I was so hungry to try to get out of my own skin.
Any aspect of your life that you're kind of cluing into fiction now, or are you firmly grounded in reality?
I've always sort of been a daydreamer. You know, it's funny. I have two children and we have all the technology and there's all the screens. And I was in class the other day and I said, I don't see kids just daydreaming anymore. You know, just sort of somebody just lying in grass in a park, not doing something. And I've always been that kind of person. And I still am to a degree. I daydream about different things now.
Brendan Schrand lives in Moscow, Idaho. You'll find more information about him and his writing at our blog, which is located at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, links to our podcast and Facebook page. I'm Cherie Newman wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.